topic before we enter part two of today's session here is social, something which you guys were very sad that we didn't talk about it enough last week. So it's definitely something which I expect to do on the June 13th another time. Last week was a bit difficult because we had the professor from MS&E who was telling us about, you know, Ken Arrow's impossibility theorem and stuff like this, and why that's interesting not be that relevant for, you know, if you want to solve a business problem. So social networks, I do hear you that you're interested in this. I personally am very interested in that, as you know. So definitely a topic which we'll do on June 13th. Second point, Wei Chong, a Singaporean friend who usually sits there, he actually set up a prediction market. I actually don't know whether he did it by himself or whether he did it in a group. Does anybody know? Did they put Wei Chong on that, or did he just do it? He should have sent you email, and if he didn't send you email, I should have sent you last night, saying that if you didn't get email by Wei Chong, then you should actually email him, so you can also play in the prediction market for startups. That's one of the things where we actually have a prediction market out for. And the benefit for the classes is 10 points for participation. So it's very easy to measure your participation in the prediction market. So guys, you know, if you want to have those 10 points, better get online today. If you have problems with your account, weichong@gmail.com, or look at the email I sent you out last night and make an account for you. Then, by the way, I lift off last night an email list. So if anybody did not get an email from you from me last night, maybe you didn't get one from last night, then please, Uri is the contact man, the hitman, for being in charge of making sure that I'm actually having access to the latest email list for you. If you didn't get email, talk to Uri. If you did get email and not from Wei Chong, then email Wei Chong that you want to play to. And maybe Evan, you'd be willing to open up to some of the insiders at Azazel. The homework 7 is coming out Wednesday. And as I briefly mentioned, it's about using CleverSet for a network of the class. And I decided, since you guys have worked hard, those people who are among the three groups of finalists for the Consumer Confidence Index Star, I know that you have a lot of work to do in the next 2 weeks, so you don't have to do the homework. You don't have to do homework 7, which is the last homework. Unless you drop out, you know, tonight after dinner, you say, you know, we drank so much wine, we don't need to do anymore, out of it. Then you have to do the work. Second, those of you who want to do a project, if you're not, then you don't have to do homework 7. So I know it's only like 3 people who want to do a project. The rest of you, I expect you to do homework 7. And it's due, as usual, the Sunday before class. Since this Sunday is Memorial Day and you'll all be partying, it will not be, you know, due this Sunday, but next Sunday. So you have essentially 10 days, I think, between Wednesday and the due date of the last homework. Any questions about logistics? Nope. Yes?
So we don't have class next week at all?
No. I mean, Memorial Day is, you know, like with Christmas and Passover, you know, very serious in this country. I would actually, when I first met for this quarter, convinced that we would have class on Monday. But now we all went to the partying route and said, you know, nobody will be here on Monday and we'll all find instead. So no class next Monday, but I will see you back in Sober the Monday thereafter at the usual time, which is class number 8. And then we have another 9 days until the final slot, which unfortunately is a slot in the middle of the day on Wednesday the 13th. Yeah?
Why can't we have our optional class, the last class, on the same day?
I can tell you very simply, I tried that very hard. I asked the secretary and the stats department to please make sure that the time slot for the finals is the same time slot as we always. And the university just cannot do it because our classroom is assigned for some other, you know, class. Plus, you might have finals at that time slot of the class. I don't know when your finals are, but they have good computer systems and they figure out to minimize sort of the old things. And that's what we ended up with. You don't have to come for the last class. I mean, I make the grades. So if you want to come, if you're interested in stuff which I'm doing, then absolutely do come. If you don't want to come because it doesn't fit in your schedule, I have total understanding and I'm not taking this student at all. By the way, only 14 people as of this morning at 2:35 a.m. had entered their wish list in the wiki class. So that is your opportunity to express yourself, what it is that you're interested in,
And just to remind you, where is that button? The button is on the class wiki page, the course wiki page. Right here, where we say, what do we say? We say June 13. There it is, June 13 wishes. That's where I have only 14 people so far, and I invite you to really think about, use the wiki structure and come up with what you think you would have done. And it's clear that, you know, if you want to know final details or find the latest, you know, this and that algorithm, that's not what we can provide, because then you'll lose everybody else. So what I want you to do, and now I'm getting back to the class today, is in this class to see data mining e-business in the big picture view. And when we need to talk about data, we talk about data. When we need to talk about it, we talk about it in a very high level, because if you dive down and we talk about implementations of neural networks and we talked about complexity regulated stuff like this. But then the problem is that we spend 3 hours on that and we don't ever get back, not only to, you know, above sea level. On that note, let's now move to the third point which we had after we talked about what's the problem, what's the data, what's the metrics. We talked to the heart of it. What is the model, Bruce?
Okay, so I want to talk about a couple of different dimensions of how recommendations are done at the highest level, positioning, of course, what Clever said is sort of my vision of where recommendations are going and the fulfillment of the approaches and the models that have been applied, the logic and integration of the approaches and models that have been applied. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce a couple of dimensions, axes or distinguishing features of recommenders. One is the evolution of comprehensiveness of the relational models behind recommendation systems, because recommendation systems have been viewed in their classic formulation as based on relational modeling. And is the notion of how static versus dynamic is the recommendation process. So first of all, relations and the kinds of relations that are incorporated into recommender systems. And I'm going to start with strawman there. I'm going to start from his collaborative filtering. And the basic idea is the collaborative filtering, as you mentioned before, looks at the single relation, the product relation, right? People who looked at X also looked at Y. That induces a relation between a pair of products. I can use that relation in what's called item collaborative filtering, which goes directly from one product to a related product. Runtime, and I, a company I think you know well, I believe, has a patent on item-to-item collaborative filtering, which is not the way filtering was originally formulated. Collaborative filtering was originally formulated in terms of a pair of relations, a relation between a person and another person, and that second person and a product. So the idea, the classic formulation of collaborative filtering is that I take a set of products that person X has viewed, I take that set of products and use that to map with people who are like person X, and then I map from that set of people back to a set of products. And that second set of products is what I recommend to the original person. So there's a map of products to people, from people back to products, and that second set of products is the recommendation set. But social network, on the other hand, exploits specifically the person-to-person recommendation without aggregating people in the middle. So it's got a recommendation from, it's got a link from a product to, it's got a link from a person to a person, and then looks directly at the second person looked at. But in either case, both of those models look at product to productions and person to person relations, and only those two relations, nothing else. Well, what we saw in our description of the data space of the data model was that, in fact, in addition to that, we have some dimensions that we might know about products. We have explicit dimensions like price, name, brand, category. Well, brand and category maybe are explicit dimensions and maybe they're not. Size, weight, color. We also have perhaps implicit dimensions that we've extracted from unstructured text or from other dimensionality reduction techniques we might have applied to other information that we have available. Like in the example that I gave about the using the Google information to present what we had about playlists. In addition to that, we have other relational information besides direct product options. So brands can be viewed as relations that as information that induces relations between products. Two products are in the same brand. That's a relation between a pair of products. We also have relations between products and people that are induced not just simply by the fact that a person viewed a product, but by the way that the light mediated the interaction between a person and a product. So I looked at a particular product in the context of a particular page, part of a particular session, and that tells me something about the relationship between me and this product. If you'd like, it's an elaboration of the relation between, of the simple fact that there is a relation between this product and me. You know, maybe I looked at it on a Saturday night, and my experience in browsing on a Saturday night is very different than my browsing on a Monday afternoon. On a Saturday night, I'm bored, I'm sitting around, I've got nothing to do, I'm just sort of generally browsing, looking for interesting things, whereas on a Monday afternoon, I tend to be a much more targeted shopper. I'm looking for a wine for the party on Friday. And hopefully what I'm looking for and I want to buy it. And so I have a very different relation with the product. It's probably not a good example of how sight mediates my relation with the product, but I think you get the idea. Okay, so the point is the relational model is going to be able to incorporate all of that information, both attribute information about the site and the person. So the links that I've got indicate that I might also know things like the demographics about the person, as well as attributes. So that's individual instance-based attributes of the product, as well as more general relational structure relating all of these elements together. The other dimension I want to look at in looking at sort of process models of recommendations is the notion of how we're handling time. And the straw man I want to put up here is behavioral targeting. So one way of looking how behavioral targeting works, and this is really it's kind of a process model or for how to do behavioral, not all behavioral targeting systems necessarily work this way, is that what we do is we take a bunch of information offline, we use it to segment the visitor space, and then we offline compute optimal recommendations for each of those segments. So we've got a number of segments or buckets or categories into which we segment the visitor space. And again, this is largely based on visitor attributes. And the visitor attributes might include time of day, how long the visitor's been on the site, other kinds of other seemingly dynamic information. But the point is, we're taking a static time slice of data, and we're using it to segment the visitor space, fixed number of buckets. And then we're attaching responses to each of those segments. And all of that is being done offline, in some kind of an offline training process.
Let me just jump in here. You know that for me as a physicist, time is always a very important thing. And let's look at the timescales which are present in this problem. So one timescale is of data. Do I look into the past? So do I just look on the current page? Does my horizon just through the current page? That's a very, you know, basically non-state approach. That's the context of the page, not the person, but the context. The next one is that I look a little bit further in the past, namely the context of the session. So I could be, I know through some ways, you know, that you're the seventh click of the session and I know where you've been before. I know that you did, but unfortunately no search result returned. I know that you modified your query and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, in both cases, let's talk about the second case right now. In the second case, I cannot have anything pre-computed because I only know your current session. So I would recommend you, unless I can do the computation real time. So here you see the trade-off. I don't have to store much data about your past, but I have to read a good computation system which now comes up with recommendations in real time. So let's go ahead of the extreme, where I don't have much compute power in real time, but I know your entire past. What would be an example for that? I would know everything I ever purchased at Amazon.com before. That would be the example where I can then, as I have some spare cycles, put what I'm going to show me next time, and I just have to look it up. Ah, Andreas Weigen, the spec. How about mending to him this and this book? So you see that there are trade-offs. And the dichotomy I just set up, in one case, no need to store any user data. Just look at the current things. Estimate the situation, but then boom, in real time, recommendations from that. Advantages, every day, millions of people show up who I can validate and improve my model on. The other example is, for all of my 50 million people, I know everything they've done before, at least I know everything they've purchased before, at least under that ID until they forgot their password, and well, if they didn't log on to their friend's name because they wanted to, etc. I can pre-compute, and I can say, hey, when the person shows up at the site next, I will show them those things. So not much needed in real time, but lots of storage needed in the CRM set. These are the different types and the different data sources.
Very nice. So in fact, Andreas has a very valid point that this category can be all the way down to the individual. And it can also be, one can view this categorization of tools, one can also view it across products. So for example, Revenue Science has a product that comes up with recommendations on a product basis. So they will offline pre-compute a categorization down to the product level, not the level, and ship you, the retailer, back a file that says, when somebody is looking at product X, recommend them products Z. So you can view it as behavioral, as a this kind of mapping, a behavioral targeting approach, with categories where the distinguishers are product being looked at, and the buckets are at the ground level of an individual product, and the response is a set of products to recommend. Alternative, or the extension of that, in one sense, is to apply what are formerly in the time series statistical community called filtering algorithms, or the HMM community at least, called filtering algorithms. The idea of a filtering algorithm is that we take data available at time t, and we use that to build a model of the current state of, let's just say the current state, let's not say of what. And based on our estimate of the current state, which will normally be a probability distribution over explicit or implicit factored and across some number of a factored state space, we use that state probabilistically, either by sampling or by computing expectations or optimizations or whatever, come up with a set of recommendations in real time from that state estimate. So this is now we're in control theory world, where we have a system we're trying to control, we have a state estimate that we induce from observations, and then we use that state to generate a control action. And then when we get a new observation, we use that new observation with our previous state estimate, we combine that with our previous state estimate to compute a state estimate. And the updated state estimate then generates, from the updated state estimate, we generate a new set of recommendations. So formally what's happening here is we're doing an information fusion process where if our state space is designed appropriately, we've got the optimal integration of all information over time, not just the current information, from which to compute optimal actions now. And the set of possible responses is no longer, well, subject to the limits of discrete computing realizable in real computers, we're no longer in a finite action space. And we're in a dynamic action space that's evolving as the visitor evolves. So in this case, as above, there's offline learning about categories of shoppers or of products. But in addition, this filtering process can be viewed as online learning, and in fact, online learning tracking, modeling, and evolution of the individual. So learning about shoppers for that site, but there's also online learning about the individual visitor. And that's it. That's sort of the high level view.
Now I think
next
time
is a drill down.
Right. So what you will see in the next half hour are very different kinds of slides. Namely, that's where we really show you actually how those models work. And just to give you a quick view over this, I mean, these are notes which I took myself. We will show you here what these are behind these statistical relational models. We will show you what the challenges are. We talked a little bit about Bayes networks, about relational models. At the key of it is that we are joined by these. And we talk about how to do inference in these Bayesian networks. And there are specifically three things you can do. You can do make predictions. You can try to do diagnostics. Or, and that's the way I think they're most often used in MS&E, you can use it for decision analysis. Then we might be willing to drill down, but I'm a little worried about that, on details, how it really works. For instance, Bruce has an algorithm, he has a patent applied for. This is amazing in terms of variable subset selection, creating lots and lots, thousands of synthetic variables, and it still works. It figures out which are the best combinations there. And then we might want to apply this to custom modeling, and let's see how you can go through there. So it's an unrealistic thing to do relational probabilistic model stuff, Nicola, takes an entire quarter for in 20 minutes. But do you think you can do it?
Well, I think we can give a flavor. I think probably the best thing to do is to be interactive at this point and see how far we get rather than have specific goals.
Important, however, that we sort of around in half an hour from now that the switch modes again from the details of the ground level, which are great. So I think nobody can tell those stories better than you do, to switch back around 5:40. And now, if you wanted to actually implement that stuff, the same step I want you to do with prediction markets, where Chong used inkling markets, I want to do the same step here, that it doesn't left hanging on, gee, you know, all these formulas and, you know, what does it mean, something away, but I want to make sure we have the last 20 minutes to lift up and say, and what actually do you need to do in order to make
right
party so you can do the last homework. Are we on the same page? Yeah. Okay. So
okay.
That's
good. So assumptions. We're going to dive down a little bit into what statistical relational models are. But first, I want to. This is in the context of how we're going to use them for building recommender systems. And so some framing assumptions. First of all, that what we can observe is shopping, right? Shopping is about building and maintaining product space awareness, and everybody shops. There's a male chauvinist perspective that women are shoppers. Men spend at least as much money as women. They just don't call it shopping. But I know I spend an enormous amount of time on electronic sites and CNET, and what am I doing? I'm building and maintaining product space awareness. People who read fishing magazines and hunting magazines are building, most of their time, building and maintaining product space awareness. What's out there? And that's not only my own model of what the important attributes are in the choice space, but also my preference model. What do I care about? It's multi-site, it's multi-session, and it's multi-thread when that happens. There's a massive amount of structured data that we have on the web. The web is wonderful. because we have a massive amount of structured observational data about people's shopping behavior and how their understanding of the space evolves and eventually leads to purchase. It's not, unfortunately, for the classical statistician, it is most of this observational data is not IID, independent and identically distributed. That's where statistical relational modeling becomes crucial for understanding this data, and that's what we're going to spend most of our time understanding. How with the fact that most of this data is not IID and can't be exploited using standard IID assumptions. Finally, if we have a chance, we'll spend it about talking about the issue of intervention and what intervention means and how we can discover the consequences of interventions, perhaps without doing a lot of experimentation. Controversial issue. So challenge. Yeah. There's a lot of challenges. Let's skip that and go on. So what I want to do is I want to present to you a little bit about statistical relational models, and then in particular dynamic statistical relational models, and how they can be used, how they can be applied in the framework that we've presented so far for modeling web visitor behavior and generating recommendations. And to do that, I'm going to have to start with sort of an underlying foundational technology that they're built on, non-relational graphical statistical models, and in particular Bayesian networks, one kind of graphical statistical model. Brief overview. So, very, very brief overview of probability from a simple perspective. A joint probability distribution. If you're in probability land, sort of a joint probabilistic modeling situation, the joint probability distribution is sort of the gold standard thing you would like to have. And an example here is I've got a sensor. The sensor either says that it, you know, kind of think about war sensors that senses when somebody walks through the door. And I have a state of the world. So I have two variables. I have, is my sensor that it can see the light or not? And I have the truth in the world of whether or not somebody is standing in the doorway. These are not the same thing, separate things, right? And I want to understand the relationship between one and the other. So I could have a joint probability distribution across those two that, you know, one time in 10,000, the sensor will report light even though there's somebody standing in the beam. Maybe they're standing just right and the light is shining between their legs. Most of the time when it reports light, there is nobody standing in the beam. Sometimes it reports no light and there's nobody standing in the beam. And sometimes it reports no light when there is somebody standing. Okay, and this is the total probability. So most of the time, nobody's standing in the beam. There's nobody there, right? But every once in a while, you can see there is somebody. And when there is, usually it does a pretty good job. It's 100 to 1 more likely that it will say, I can't see any light when there's somebody there. Yeah?
So just if you add up the two, like the error cases, they add up to almost like as much as the right case. They both add up to 0.01, so it's like...
Yeah. Life is like that. And that's why in the medical community, my wife has a degree in public health, that's why in the medical community it drives people crazy when people say, I want to be tested. Don't waste anybody's money. The false positives are so high that unless you've got a good prior probability of having this disease, it's stupid to test you for it because the false positive is so high.
There are two good examples for that. One is B testing is an example. The other one is the burglar example, mm-hmm. that people are just not good in assessing properties.
Right.
And so if you frame it, I think in that specific example, the door was left ajar and the burglar comes and the alarm goes off. That's something which people remember much better than if you just say, you know, somebody setting the lie detector.
Yeah.
We are just not good in reasonabilities, and that's why this Bayes rule actually helps us make much better inferences about the world than if we just go by our feelings, made to deal with probabilities. The discussion, by the way, we had an overconfidence. I did not get email from somebody last time. Did you close the loop with me on that? No.
No, I didn't.
Okay, I just realized it right now. So overconfidence is one example. Show us that there are good probabilities, and I want to close the loop with you on that after class today.
Okay.
Okay. So So the point is, if you have a table like this, you can answer any question you want within the context of those two variables fairly simply. So if you tell me it reports no light, I will tell you that, in fact, there's a 50-50 chance there's somebody in the beam, essentially. 0.0099 versus 0.01. Those two numbers are almost the same. But I can compute that from that table. The challenge is that as the number of variables, the number of parameters in my situation grows, if they're all discrete, the size of this table, this fully specified table, is exponential, the number of parameters I have, and it very quickly gets difficult to specify all the numbers, as well as, you know, intractable to manage the table, just because it gets so large. Can't store it, can't compute with it. So that's where we're at until the early 1980s, when Jutta Perl at UCLA and Stefan Larsson at Aalborg in Denmark and a number of other people started to discover an interesting connection between graph theory and probability, and realized that if you have a DAG over a set of variables, and if you make an assumption that missing arcs in the DAG imply a conditional independence in the probability distribution, then you can tractably represent and compute with very complex situations. So if we have a DAG.
You know what a DAG is, by the way.
Directed acyclic graph. Let me see. Here's a better one. Here's a more complex graph. Okay, so here's a slightly more complex graph over a set of variables. The set of variables are, was there an earthquake? Was there a burglary? Either could set off my alarm. If my burglar alarm is set off, I'll get a phone call. But an earthquake could also cause a report saying that there was an earthquake. You know, a news report will appear on the radio. So this is a directed acyclic graph. There's no loops. If you follow the cycles, if you follow the arrows, you can never get back to a variable that you started from. The fact that there is no arc between earthquake and phone says that if I know whether or not the alarm went off, then telling me whether or not there was an earthquake does not change the probability that I will get a phone call. All I need to know is whether the alarm went off. That's the only thing, if you'd like, that causes the phone call. If that's the case, then if I believe the missing arcs imply independence in the joint probability distribution, then there, and if I acquire a set of numbers that's defined by this graph that are local, if I acquire the probability of alarm given earthquake, the probability of phone call only given alarm, in other words, for each variable, the probability of that variable given only its immediate parents, then there's a theorem that says I have uniquely defined, there is guaranteed to, if I satisfy simple local constraints on each of those probability distributions, namely that the conditional probability rose to 1. That's the only constraint there, isn't there? Every probability is between 0 and 1, the standard constraints for probabilities. Then there is guaranteed to be a single unique joint probability distribution over all those variables, and that single unique joint probability distribution can be recovered by taking the product of all those conditional distributions. So the breakthrough here is that we have a representation that makes no independence assumptions, that allows you to specify all of the crucial relationships in a situation. It allows you to tractively specify or learn or discover, as we'll see, a complete probability model over an arbitrarily large set of variables. And it turns out that for which there are efficient algorithms, both for the structure and the distributions, and for computing with them in real time as you get data. Huge breakthrough is that this graphical models in general have swept at least the artificial intelligence community and many other communities in terms of modeling data where there's any uncertainty involved. So vision, speech, biological gene expression models, many communities have adopted these graphical models as the basic underlying representations. The trick is that the graphs have to be sparse, and the interesting thing is that they generally are, either because you don't have enough data to learn, or because, well, you have some really interesting arguments that in fact they stay sparse because, especially in domains that have existed for a long time, because human language has been formulated precisely because of our inability to simply remember large amounts of complex relationships, has been formulated in such a way that the graphs are sparse. So for example, there's a couple of ways of motion. And the fact that we model motion in terms of position and acceleration gives us a factored model. Okay. So, what do we do with these graphs? What can we do with probability distributions? There's three classes of things that we can do in general given a graphical model like this. Given a set of data, we can do, will the car start? And by prediction here, generally what I mean is sort of following the arrows. I have upstream data, like the battery is charged, the fuel gauge says that the fuel tank is full, and I want to know is, will the car start? So I can do prediction. But in fact, the algorithms are the direction arcs is independent of the direction of inference. I can ask any question from the joint probability distribution. The direction of the arcs is knowledge representation convenience. So from the diagnostic perspective, which is one of the places where the theory evolved from, I can ask questions in the opposite direction. I can say, my car does not start. What's wrong with it? And get posterior distributions on whether the system is broken, whether I don't have any fuel, or whether it's simply that the battery is broken. And for decision analysis, with some slight elaborations, we need to add a preference model as well as and an action model as well as the belief model, the model over how the world works, the relationship between the variables in the world. I can do decision analysis to find an option to take. That's outside the scope of what we'll talk about now, but there's a couple of levels of sophistication of what we can do there. So that's the underlying sort of base theory that is the Excel spreadsheet of the modeling world. Okay, up to this point, we are at machine learning a la 1995, right? I always thought machine learning was sort of the most sophisticated part of artificial intelligence, which, if you like, was the sophisticated part of computer science, you know, way out there on the leading edge, doing anything far better than anyone else in the world was doing. The interesting thing to observe is that machine learning was the last place in computer science to abandon the 1960s flat file data model. Programming languages abandoned it in the late 1960s with SimScript and object-oriented programming languages. File storage abandoned it in the mid-1970s with relational database. Machine learning was stuck with the idea that, oh, you got to feed me a single file of data and I will run my machine learning. So statistics. Basically, if you want to run a statistical algorithm, you need to get it, right? If you've got a data, you've got to extract a flat file and give it to your statistician. Well, why is that? Because they got a flat file data model. Well, somebody figured out that that's broken. And the challenge here is, why do we care? Why do we care about flat file data models? The issue is that a flat file data model is an imposition of IID across the rows in that file. If you think about, let me go back here. If you think about this model, what you can think of this as identifying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 variables. So think of those 9 variables as a data set. I've got 9 columns and some number of rows of cars that came into the shop to be repaired, right? And I could learn this model over that data file. What I've done is I've relaxed the IID assumption across the columns. I've said I know which columns are related to which other columns and what the relationships are. And I've done that without imposing some arbitrary dumb model of relationships like a linear model or and done linear regression or done some other fixed framework. This is a model-free way of representing the dependencies across the columns data set. That's the breakthrough in Bayesian networks. The breakthrough in probable relational models or statistical relational models is that it's a way of relaxing the independence assumption across the rows in the data set. Rows and relaxing the independence assumption across the rows in the data set. What the hell does that mean? Well, I've got 3 page views in my session log. Well, one of the things I notice is those page views are all from the same visitor. Well, they're not independent. They are related to one another by virtue of the fact that they all have the same visitor. If I extract visitor out of the model and make that a separate entry in my call it a relational data model, call it a schema, call it an ontology. If you're not comfortable with any of those, I'm sorry, I can't help you. It's a new world. If I extract that and make it an entity, what I realize is that there's an entity that exists at a different granularity. There is one visitor that all of those rows are related to, and the fact that, all 3 of those rows are for a single visitor induces a relationship among them, makes them independent of one another. They are not IID, whereas they may be independent with their IID condition on the visitor, but they're not independent if I don't condition on the visitor. There's a sequential relationship in time among those, in addition. So, the point is that I've got a relational data, and here's a simple example of a relational data structure over a simple web visit where I have an individual page request. Individual page request is part of a session, and all the pages that are part of a session are related to one another. My intent in this particular session might be different than my intent in some other session, but nonetheless, all the sessions that I participate in are related to one another, for the fact that they're all my sessions and they're not your sessions. In addition, a particular page request might share is also not independent of other requests for that same page. So independent of the fact that I looked at page X and I looked at page Y, and that introduces a relation between page X and page Y, there's also, or that my request for page X is related to my request for page Y by virtue of the fact that I did both of those. There's also a relation between my request for page X and your request for page X by virtue of the fact that that both of those requests were for page X. So there's this relational structure over page requests, what they mean and how they should be interpreted. How they should be clustered, aggregated, interpreted. That's based on the relationships that those requests participate in across the visitor, across the site structure, and across the product catalog. The 3 fundamental actions are for that. So we can start to flesh out a relational model, a graphical relational, over, let me skip ahead a little bit. We wanted to end at 9:40, right? Where do I want to go here? I want to skip down to this slide.
And we'll put all the slides up, so don't panic copying down all the graphs from this one here.
So I can start to flesh out a relational model over a web visit. What does a relational model look like? What it's composed of? Again, it's composed of graphical models over sets of variables, where a set of variables is a set of variables defined with respect to a schema element. So I might have a model for a visitor, a model for a session, a model for a page view within a session. I might have a model for a product in my catalog. I might have a model for a brand. I might have a model for a particular page on the website. For each of those models are all going to be related to one another. But what are the variables in the model? In a traditional single table model, the variables were basically the columns in my table. What did I have? As a statistician, you know that the variables might also include what are called derived features. I might have age, I might have weight, for example, in a medical example, but I might also have age-adjusted weight as a derived variable that I compute some function of age and weight, and I might add that as a synthetic or derived variable. And most statistical package will support you defining those kinds of things and automatically computing. Well, so in a relational data model, one can do the same thing, but the derived features become database queries over the database. So for example, a derived variable for a page view might be the total number of seconds since the beginning of the session. Or it might be the number of product views of products that cost more than $75, which the visitor has never viewed in any previous session. Or any kind of database query you can think of expressing over your entire database that describes visitor sessions. Finally, and what makes life interesting, some of those variables are going to be unobserved variables, or can be unobserved variables. So we can think of finding unobserved features of the state space for any one of the tables or winning entries in the schema. The application of a model like that then involves a three-step process. There's an offline process for training the model, online process for applying in real time using basically standard tracking and filtering methods extended into this relational data modeling space. And there are some references on the CleverSec website. I can provide you some additional references. There's some there's quite a bit of information for our referral data. But that's sort of a high-level flavoring of how we get from a data set to a graphical model, what a graphical model over this kind of data means. We're at 5:40. So I can do another spiral or I can stop right here. I think we probably want to move on.
Yes.
High-level application.
So let's do this. I know it's okay for more than an hour. Let's give people like 3 minutes to just stretch before we go into the last 20 minutes. And just to put in your mind, this is the definition Bruce and I believe in. What actually is it, what we want to do here in the rest? We want to talk about recommendations again or recommendations. What is a recommendation? It is an algorithm for choosing a subset of items from a given catalog to present to a given visitor in a given situation, optimizing some objective function. That's what we're doing. And I invite you again to think about the different applications. One of them could be like for navigation. Think about navigation. You want to show some navigation. Navigation falls under this. It's choosing a subset of a catalog, which would be navigation items, to present to a given visitor in a given situation, optimizing some objective function. Think ads. Think dating sites. You know,
What are you doing? You're choosing a subset of items from a given catalog to present to a given visitor in a given situation. Bruce already mentioned time of day, could be potentially an important variable, or some objective function. And that can be local in time, or it can be extending over the time. Minutes break, just really 3 minutes, so actually I can quickly also upload my MP3 file, and then we talk about recommendations 1.0, how we move to recommendations 2.0, what it really means, and what the application of CleverSet means in some of the examples which you have done actually. Okay?